It's Saturday, April 29th, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Lubbock, Texas. Welcome to a special podcast, which is actually a rebroadcast of a presentation given yesterday at the Texas Tech University College of Education by Dr. David Berliner, a professor at Arizona State University. Dr. Berliner's topic is the No Child Left Behind Act, and specifically the impact of high-stakes testing upon students, not only here in Texas, but across the entire nation. And while I don't think any single individual has all the answers to what we need with regard to school reform and school improvement in the United States, I definitely think that Dr. Berliner has one of the most articulate presentations and one of the most persuasive presentations that a wide variety of stakeholders need to listen to and consider when thinking about school reform and how we can improve education in the 21st century. As always, I would welcome any comments, suggestions, or feedback that you would have from this podcast or any of the other blog material that is found on my blog, Moving at the Speed of Creativity, at www.speedofcreativity.org.
Thank you, Dean Santos. That was a very nice introduction. Can't possibly live up to it, but I should tell you that although we have many educators in our family, I was secretly wishing for a lawyer or a business major. Oh well, you succeed in some things and not in others. Let me start off this morning, let me start off by putting my watch out, so I am a professor, I could go all day, see if I can keep it to the time allotted. Let me start off with my own positions, and I think you need to know that before I talk about some other things. We have developed a standards movement in the U.S., math, science, art, history, as you all know. Standards also influenced by the national associations, the math teachers, the science teachers. And they're influencing what is taught and at what grades things will be taught. It is not a national curriculum yet, but it's a convergence, so that more than ever, the 50 states and our 15,000 school districts are beginning to look alike. This is good. I like curriculum standards. If they have four characteristics, those are that teachers are involved in making them, that professional associations are involved in making them, that there's a small number of standards for teachers to try to reach in every grade, and that they're revisited often. Under those conditions, standards are good, I think, particularly in the U.S., like our modern society, where children are mobile. Many schools, 20 to 50% of the kids are moving in and out. It's not unusual to have 80% of the kids gone from kindergarten to sixth grade even, and only 20% left. Given modern America, putting kids district to district with completely different curricular standards makes no sense. That was fine for a rural time when you lived within 20 miles of where you grew up. So I'm very much for the standards movement. I also believe in accountability, but I believe in two-way accountability, a concept not usually thought about. Two-way accountability is where the cities and states are responsible for sending healthy children to school, and the schools are responsible for educating students well. We only have one-way accountability now, where only the schools are accountable, and it's not fair. We have too many children in poverty, and too many without any medical insurance, and too many living in deteriorating neighborhoods and houses, and it is hard to educate such children well. No nation does this well. I'll come back to this. But we also need to remember that accountability means to give an account, to have those affected tell what is happening to them. There is virtually no evidence that anyone in Washington is listening to the voices of teachers, parents, administrators, and others concerned about our schools. If you're going to have accountability, the people being affected by your programs need to give their account. And the pig-headed know-nothings who are designing our school programs simply are fostering a very narrow view of accountability on the rest of us, and I don't like that part of it. I also believe in testing, particularly formative assessment, which is a great help to teachers and schools. So I'm not against standards, testing, evaluation, accountability, and assessment at all. What I am against, and we'll talk the rest of the morning about, is the heavy use of what we call high-stakes testing, almost invented single-handedly in your fair state. High-stakes testing has to do with bonuses for student scores, the pay for performance based on student scores, the closing down of schools, the removal of teachers and administrators for the test, leaving kids back, exit exams so you can't graduate high school without the passing a test. That's all high-stakes testing. It's part of our federal program called No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind has heavy reliance on high-stakes testing. And what I'd like to move into now, that you know where I stand, is my assertions that No Child Left Behind cannot work, that it does not work, and that it's corrupting our profession. And I'll talk about those now. Now, I said No Child Left Behind cannot work. There are many reasons for this, but one is that you cannot get 100% of the kids to proficient, which is required by law, ever. It's impossible to get 100% of kids to do anything. I mean, show up on time, line up for the bathroom. It doesn't matter. You cannot get 100% of the kids to do that. The fools in Washington either have no children or purposely wanted to embarrass our schools. Kids differ, okay? Fundamental to educational psychology and all of psychology is individual differences. There is no field of psychology without individual differences. This is completely ignored by the people who wrote No Child Left Behind. So it cannot work. It's a fact of life that getting two kids to exactly the same place in exactly the same amount of time is, people who believe you can do that are completely out of touch with reality. We usually have drugs for those people. But I mean, think of it. A whole bunch of kids, 100% in exactly the same time to a certain criteria. It's impossible that anyone would think that could happen. Second, under present growth rates on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP test, it will be 50 to 75 years to get most kids even close to the proficient level on that test. Most of the politicians who set that proficient level will be out of office. They'll be gone. But they said it, and then they said, lots of luck. What was not noted is that it will be 50 to 2,000 years to close the gap between whites and blacks and whites and Hispanics on the present growth rates. 2,000 years is a long time to wait for closing that gap. But if you take the estimates and just run the curves out, we don't close the gaps for 2,000 years, two millennia. This is not good for America, but nobody seems to have noticed that. The third,
okay, there.
And I think we need the lights dimmed up front. Yeah, that should come on in a minute. A third point is that the procedures used, now will designate about 90% of all schools as failing in the nation. And California, in fact, will actually have 99% of the schools failing. Again, this is a bill that cannot work and seems designed instead to embarrass school personnel and drive more folks to vouchers. Thank you. Okay, let's look at those who rely on high-stakes testing and what they say about it and how it works. The proponents of high-stakes testing say things like, students work harder and learn more when they have to take high-stakes tests. Well, that's certainly true for some students, but it's not true for all students. There are a lot of students who just say, no, I'm not going to do that. It's an imposition on my time. I don't like your tests. They embarrass me. They turn off. So it's not automatic that students will do that. The supporters also say that students will be motivated to do their best and score well on these high-stakes tests. Some will. Some won't. In fact, some purposely won't. It's a form of passive aggression against the system they're not sure they like. Kids at South Mountain High School in Phoenix very often fill out the answer sheets when they're given tests just before Christmas. They fill out C, B, D, A, E, C, 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 and they build Christmas trees on all the columns. So it's not clear that every student is motivated. Scoring well on the test will lead to feelings of success, while scoring poorly on such tests will lead to increased effort to learn. People smoke funny cigarettes who make who say this thing. This is simply a pipe dream, literally a pipe dream, okay? There are some students who, when they feel they have failed, will redouble their efforts. That's the goal of all of us, to have the kind of kid who says, I take responsibility for my failure, I'm going to work harder. An awful lot of kids say, I failed, I'm dumb, I'm out of here. Okay? So they internalize the failure and they don't work harder, they walk with their feet and go out. So these are all half-truths rather than full-truths about how high-stakes testing might work. It's further argued that students and teachers need high-stakes tests to know what is important to learn and to teach. Well, that's silly. We have scope and sequence charts and have had them for years. We have curriculum guides. We have textbooks. We have all sorts of things that tell us what to teach. We don't need the test to tell us what to teach. In fact, if the test tells us what to teach, we've abrogated our responsibilities as curriculum developers. The test is not the curriculum. The test should reflect the curriculum. The curriculum decisions are more important. It's argued that teachers need to be held accountable through high-stakes tests to motivate them to teach better and push the laziest ones to work harder. Now understand, this is the theory of action that undergirds No Child Left Behind. The basic assumption is the little buggers are lazy and so are their teachers and we got to get them all to work harder. That's why this law was written. It's the belief that the teachers and students are sloughing off. So that's the theory of action behind No Child Left Behind. And it's simply not true. Teachers work very, very hard. The number of really lazy teachers I've seen in 1,000 classroom visits can be counted on one hand. And they're far fewer than the number of lazy people I've seen in any other business I've ever visited in my life. Okay. Supporters of high-stakes testing assume also that the tests are good measures of the curricula that students are taught in schools. Parents seem to think this all the time. They don't understand that the curriculum is like this, and you pull 30 items out, and that's your test. You never sample a curriculum well with a test. Never. Unless you've got some sort of curriculum embedded testing along the way. But we're using high-stakes outcome measures, not some form of formative assessments along the way. The supporters also say that the tests provide a kind of level playing field, an equal opportunity for all students to demonstrate their knowledge. That's true if and only if all students have had the opportunity to learn the same things. If you can make a case that students have not had the opportunity to learn the same things, you can't hold them to the same proficiency level. It's basically un-American, and I'll come back to that. High-stakes tests are no longer obviously biased, and now they're good measures of an individual's performance, little affected by motivation, emotionality, language, and social status. This is crazy talk by people who never talk to children. A test in English is a test of English. We start with that. And so right off the bat, you disadvantage all English language learners if you're testing them out of the language they're proficient in. Social status matters a lot. The award-winning article this year at AERA, just a couple of weeks ago, was an article on the relationship of social class to school achievement. It was a wonderful meta-analysis. The correlation between social class and school achievement is regularly found, it is high. Nobody seems to want to accept it as causal. I mean, you get a dozen studies showing correlation between cigarettes and lung cancer, and everyone says it's causal, and so you put labels on cigarette packs. You have absolutely no experimental studies that show that cigarettes cause cancer. None at all. Okay? You have a theory. In the case of social class of achievement, we have 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 articles showing a relationship between social class and achievement, and no one says it's causal. It is. Okay? There are things embedded in poverty that almost invariably, lots of exceptions, but group data almost invariably lead to lower achievement. The problem for us is that a resilient kid, or a teacher that's unique, or a school that's unique, and shows achievement among low poverty kids, we all point to that and say, see, they can do it. But those are the exceptions. The basic rule of group data is quite clear. The lower your family income, the worse you're going to do in school because of what's associated with low income. And that needs to be taken into account. Finally, the supporters believe that teachers use test results to help provide better instruction for individual students. That might be true if the results ever showed up on time. Typically, a test is given in April. Typically, the results show up in August. So you've got a new batch of kids, and what good are they? Okay. That's a typical pattern. That administrators use the results to improve student learning and design better professional development? Ha! Most school districts haven't a clue how to do data-based decision-making. Only the richest districts have a research office that can actually sit down with the data and say, oh, we're not doing quadratic equations well. We probably ought to put in a unit on quadratic equations. I mean, the analysis is highly difficult. And small districts without research departments can't do this. And professional development keeps getting cut in the budget cuts, particularly in your state. Finally, it's argued that parents understand the scores on high-stakes tests and how to interpret their children's scores. Well, that's silly. There isn't a parent in the country who could tell me what grade level equivalent means. In fact, most teachers can't tell me what it means. That's really a very strange concept. And if I asked people in this room what grade level equivalency is, I'd get 100 different answers. Okay, a few of them might. Okay, so it's all of the arguments made for high-stakes testing can be countered. In fact, there's always been problems with high-stakes testing. Can anyone here give me the date of these notes written by a Department of Education to a legislature that was putting in high-stakes testing? Here's the note from the Department of Ed to the legislature. They said, it is an evil for a well-taught, well-trained student to fail in an examination. It is an evil for an unqualified student, through some inefficiency of the test, to obtain credit in an examination. It is a great and more serious evil by too frequent and too numerous examinations so as to magnify their importance, that students come to regard them not as a means in education, but as the final purpose, the ultimate goal of an education. And finally, it is a very great and most serious evil to sacrifice systematic instruction and a comprehensive group view of the subject for the scrappy and unrelated knowledge gained by students who are persistently drilled in the mere answering of questions issued by the education department or other governing bodies. Well, the language is archaic, you can see that. You already know it's old. Anyone want to guess when it was written?
5 years ago.
Anyone else? 1906. Exactly 100 years ago. Having learned nothing from history, we move on. This is prescient stuff. The State Department of Education telling the legislature, this doesn't work. You're going to screw up education. We learned nothing from history. One of the big problems for our schools is that things that go on outside of our schools affect what teachers and administrators can reasonably do. They cannot produce miracles in a society willing to allow for so many difficult childhoods as ours does. Now, I'm going to say some things about our society that are not nice, and I'm sorry. I love my country, but it's important to point out when it does things that are not nice. Here's the data on poverty rates, 1990 to 2000, released by UNICEF, the Innocenti Foundation in Europe, and it lists the rich countries and the percent of children in poverty. You'll notice next to the bottom is the USA. They slipped one in on me. They put Mexico in as a rich country, which surprised me since I live along the border, as many of you know, Mexico. Although it qualifies essentially as a rich country, its per capita income is about $7,000 a year, and ours is about $34,000 a year. There's a big difference between us and Mexico. Unfortunately, the percentage of children in poverty, they're one of our closest neighbors. We should never, in my mind, have Mexico as a peer group for children in poverty. But in fact, in modern times, they're a closer peer group than some of our other, what we usually think of as our other countries that we're related to. What's interesting to notice is that the percentage of children in poverty, and this is using the same standards in every country, it's a very well-recognized procedure. If you look at Denmark or Finland or Norway or Sweden or Switzerland or Czech Republic, you're talking of an average of 3 or 4% of the children in those countries in poverty. You're talking about 21%, 22% of the children in the U.S. being in poverty. The U.S. likes to be number one, and we are. We're number one in children in poverty, among the richest nations in the world. Well, it's a position we prize. You know. We like to be number one. It's really an embarrassment that a country this rich has so many children in poverty. I might add also that these data, given 22% as the percentage of kids in poverty, finished in the year 2000. You notice what happened right after that. We went into a rather serious recession. And it is quite likely that the percentage of children in poverty is up around 24% now, not 22%. Okay? If you take the poverty level and then go half of that, and you need to understand the poverty level set in this country is set ridiculously low. It's $20,000 for a family of four. I mean, that's abject poverty, not poverty. Okay, so most people use 200% of that as the poverty level, which would be $40,000 for a family of four, or 150%, $30,000. But nobody uses the government, which is $20,000 for a family of four. This is half the number of that. Okay, this is people at half the level of the government poverty line. And you'll notice from 1975 to 2002, it's straight up, and a little zing at the end, like I said, because we went into recession there. Now, these are the abject poor, half of the poverty rate. These are millions of families and children, and it's on the increase. Now, I ask a simple question. Why would you expect increased school achievement when the percentage of your children in abject poverty is going up? Makes no sense to me. If you don't work on this, you're not going to get the kinds of school achievement you want. Here's something else about the United States I've always found interesting. The United States is highlighted up at the top. The next column after countries are the number of poor, I'm sorry, the percentage of poor who are poor once in 3 years. Now everybody, every country rather, has people who fall into poverty. The big four in the United States are divorce, illness, childbirth, job loss. Okay? Those four account for like 80 or 90% of the people who go from a middle class standard to a poverty standard. Okay? So it happens to people. Life happens. Okay? People fall into poverty. The U.S. rate at 23.5 is high, but it's not the highest on this list. Even Finland, a very rich nation, has people who fall into poverty at higher rates. So the U.S. is high, but not out of sight. It's the column after that that says poor in all 3 years. The number of people who fall into poverty and stay into poverty in the United States, we're the highest in the world. That is, once you fall below those social barriers we have, not social barriers, the nets, the social nets, and you fall under them, it's hard to get out of them. The United States is the highest rate of all these nations of people who fall into poverty and stay there for 3 years. Move over one more column, we win again. This is the percentage of permanently poor. Once you fall into poverty in the U.S., it's very hard to get out. This is not a kind nation to the poor. We have some crazy notion running through this nation that there are the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. Okay? And we put a lot of people in this category called undeserving poor. And other nations don't quite look at it that way. They look at the poor and say we need to fix it. I had a fascinating occurrence once in Helsinki, walking down the street, and I had just come from San Francisco, and I said to my host, where are your homeless people? And he said, why homeless people? And I said slower and louder, where are your homeless people? You know, homeless, homeless. And he said, I don't understand the question. And again, louder and slower, I asked, where are your homeless people? And he said, we don't have homeless people. And I said, why? And he looked at me like I was a fool and said, we get them homes. Duh! I mean, it's just stuff that's acceptable here is unacceptable in some other nations. Now, things change. We have neoliberal economies in Europe, too, and there's more of a market and less of a socialist flavor to the economies there. So they're going through changes too, but they really do care in a way different than we do about our poor, I think. Okay. The next thing to notice about poverty is that it's racialized. You look at the poverty rates in the U.S., you can see white, non-Hispanic at the bottom here, relatively steady, and you can see African-American and Hispanic poverty at much higher rates than whites, and also relatively steady. And again, I point out that at the end, the zig and the zag is up because of the recession from 2000 up to just about today. So we have a racialized system. So white children and children of color are likely to be getting different educations, but No Child Left Behind seems to demand that they all have equal education as a condition of holding them to the same standards. You can't do that. New teachers, out-of-field teachers, alternatively certified teachers, less board-certified teachers, less AP classes are all available for poor kids. They get the newest teachers. In fact, some of the best data I have on teacher proficiency is Texas data, done by a student whose dissertation I worked on, Omar Lopez at UT Austin. And he plotted at the State Department, he plotted years of teaching against student achievement. And it's a curve that goes straight up for 7 years. Okay? So for 7 years, teachers get better at producing student achievement on your state test. At the end of 7 years, the curve goes this way, relatively flat. I won't burden you with a problem. At the end of about 22 years, the curve goes down a little. People get tired. But actually, the variance increases out there. So some people are still growing while others are going down. But the point is that new teachers, people who come into the field and leave in 2 years, like Teach for America teachers, or new teachers that say, these conditions are awful, I'm out of here, they're not hitting their stride until they're in their fifth, sixth, seventh year. And these are the teachers, it's the new teachers that the poor kids get in every state in the union. Okay? Teachers who are... Ignorant is not a pejorative term, it's a descriptive term. New teachers are ignorant. They're ignorant of how schools work, how kids learn, etc. They learn it, fortunately, but they're ignorant, and our most needy children get our most ignorant teachers. So it's racialized. In fact, one of the important things to note is that these are the minority makeups of schools and who's in them. And you can see on that first line of row across that 88% of white students attend majority white schools, but only 25% of black and Latino students attend majority white schools. 75% of America's minorities attend schools that are majority minority, often overwhelmingly so. At the bottom, you see, bottom right hand corner, black students, 18% of black students attend schools that are 99 to 100% black. Jonathan Kozol says we are running an apartheid state school system. And Jonathan Kozol is right. It's not the mean apartheid of South Africa. It's a friendly apartheid of the U.S. But it is apartheid. We're running separate and unequal school systems. And if you want everybody to achieve a No Child Left Behind test, you can't hold them to the same standards when you've got apartheid schooling and the kinds of problems that go with that. Okay. The results of all this, when we test, are easy to see in the international tests. What happens to our minorities is quite clear when we go to the international realm. These are the 2000 PISA science studies. PISA is the Program on International Student Assessment. It's run by the OECD, European Union. It measures a whole bunch of countries, mostly European and some others like Japan, the US, Canada, and does it in math, science, and reading every 3 years. And you can expect the PISA reports out every couple of years. I picked science here to show you something interesting. In the center, the United States, the average U.S. score is 499, right around the mean of 500 that they try to they build the scale around. When you disaggregate the data, you notice something interesting. Up at the top, the United States white kids are the fourth highest performing science in the world, in the science test. Our black and Hispanic students down at the bottom are third from the bottom, closer to Mexico and Brazil than they are to Korea and Japan. Okay? Once you disaggregate the data, you see what our racialized and poverty does for us in international competition. We're almost always average in international competition. And the reason for that is we're combining schools of excellence and schools of shame. We put them all together and we hide the variation in the U.S. schools. So average is never good enough for everybody. We all want to live in Lake Wobegon. We want everybody above average. But the fact of the matter is, it's hiding our real shame. And it's hiding our excellence. The 20 school districts north of Chicago competed in one of the TIM studies, the Trends in International Math and Science Studies. The 20 school districts north of Chicago competed as a nation. They said, we're damn good. We don't want to be melded in with the rest of the United States. We're damn good. We'll show you how good we are. Treat us as a nation. So they were treated as a nation, the 20 school districts. They placed second in the world in mathematics and first in the world, tied for first in science. 20 public schools that work well. Why do they work well? They've got lots of money. They pay teachers well. When you turn on a computer, it opens up. They have track and field, with a real track and a real field. Kids go to Europe in the summer. Healthcare is for everybody. Every kid has healthcare. I mean, it's the way America ought to run, because we're rich enough to have this for everybody. But it sadly doesn't. Okay? So we're fourth in the world in science. I have the same data in mathematics and in reading. And if we just pull out the white scores, and by the way, of the 50 million kids in school, about 30 million of them are white. So this is not an insignificant number. We're talking about 30 million U.S. kids, undifferentiated by social class. I'm not talking about poor whites on the plains here in Texas. I'm not talking about Appalachian whites who are dirt poor. I'm talking about whites as a group. Okay, our privileged class in America. I'm talking about whites as a group. We are fourth in the world in science. We are second in the world in reading, and we are seventh in the world in mathematics. Lots of our kids are doing well in school. The kids who are not doing well are poor, and in this country that often means kids of color. Okay. Here's PEARLS, the Progress in International Reading Literacy. This is 9 and 10 year olds in 35 countries. I like to show this when I come to Texas, because the U.S. ranked 9th out of 35 countries and statistically was 3rd in the world. Statistically, we're 3rd in the world in reading, while our president and the Secretary of Education you gave us, Rod Page, simply went out in the country and lied about our school system. They seemed to have some trouble reading the data, and they were talking about American kids can't read. In the 1992 international assessment of reading, U.S. 9-year-olds and 14-year-olds came in second and tied for first. In 1992. In 2002, or 2001, when this study was run, we tied for third statistically. Okay? This is a nation that's reading just fine. And they go around saying it can't read, meaning maybe that they can't read. Okay. So, but here's the interesting part given the poverty issues. The score of U.S. white children without any concern about social class was 565. That is, Sweden, which won the race, at 561. Our white kids beat up their white kids. Okay? We outscored them. Okay? You go down a little lower here, you look at the score of children in schools where under 10% are eligible for free and reduced lunch, that is, wealthier schools. They scored 585. They creamed the world. Okay? Kids in schools that have some wealth in the community are doing just fine in America. Just fine. Here's what else PEARLS revealed. The score of children where more than 75% of the children are eligible for free and reduced lunch was 485, way down with the lesser performing nations. And compared to other nations, the USA had the largest urban-suburban score differences in the entire study. We have wealth in the suburbs, poverty in the inner cities, and it's really hurting us, and it shows up in the international studies very clearly. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so we see how it is problematic to have a pre-specified cut score and deny high school degrees or leave students back on the basis of their test scores when they are clearly not performing the same. It's a form of institutional racism unless you can look four kids in the eye and say, you kids have been given the same opportunities as your middle class kids across town. We've given you the same opportunities, so we're holding you to the same standards. If you can do that, that's fine. I can't. I can't look the four kids in South Phoenix in the eye and tell them they're getting the same education as the kids in North Scottsdale. I don't know. I think our state superintendent can do it, but he lies all the time. you can only use these high-stakes tests after equal opportunities have been given. Okay, so let's ask the next question. Okay, even with all those troubles, is it working? Is it promoting? Is it getting the scores up? As if scores were the only outcome of schooling. Well, let's look at that now. Here's how we studied it the first time. We took a state, in this case, Alabama. We plotted Alabama scores on tests like the ACT, this is for the ACT, or the SAT, the two high school graduation tests, the NAEP tests. We took their scores for a 20-year period. And then we asked, did they put in a high-stakes test, a high school exit exam in this case? Did they say, you have to pass this test or you can't graduate? In terms of Alabama, they put one in 1983, that's where the diamond is, the first diamond. And on this chart, they put a second test in 1992. Now, when they put their first test in, they saw their scores go up on the ACT, and they said, high-stakes testing works. If we hold those little buggers accountable, they'll start performing. If we slap those lazy teachers with a big test, the kids will start performing. So that's the decision they made. We went back and put in the national data set to compare it to the state data set. You will notice something interesting. Everybody got smarter in those years. Okay? The ACT, a little glitch in the ACT scoring, and the scores went up, and Alabama doesn't look any different than anybody else in the state. In fact, if you look at how they scored after that, there's a little decline, and it's actually their second test probably shows no difference at all when they put it in. So Alabama has no case to make that its high-stakes testing are, in fact, increasing achievement on something like the ACT. And it's an ACT state. They use a lot of, like 80% of the kids take ACTs or something like that. We would do it for the NAEP test too. Here's the state of Georgia. They put in a high-stakes test. They put it in before our data set. We had our data set, so I don't show a diamond here, but they had a test in. You can see the scores are flat for Georgia for a while, and then they go up, and Georgia's very pleased. Their high-stakes testing is making a difference. Plotted against the nation, everybody went up. Okay? Georgia has no leg to stand on here. We did this for a whole bunch of data sets, and here are the conclusions we got. On the first row, we looked at fourth grade NAEP tests for 27 states. Out of those, we found unambiguous data on 12 states. The reason the data is ambiguous is some different states have different rates of exclusion of kids, as you know. For example, it wouldn't surprise you to know that on the NAEP test, North Carolina and Texas had the highest rates of exclusion of kids on the NAEP test during the time period we were studying this. It's changed now, they've tightened up on that. But there's a real easy way to get your scores up. You throw out all the English language learners and the special ed kids. And when you realize you can do that, you identify a whole bunch of special ed kids. Thousands of newly discovered learning disabled kids. ADHD. The kid moved in his chair, get him rid of him, he's out of here. Okay? So you can identify the kid and get him out of a testing situation, if it's a low scoring kid. If it's a high scoring kid that moves, you keep him there. Okay? So this is what was happening. So there were a whole bunch of things we looked at, and we had to ask the questions about, do we trust the data? In 12 cases, we trusted the data, and it was negative in 8 and positive in 4. That is, the outcomes on the NAEP test went down as a function of high-stakes testing for 4th grade math. On 8th grade math, we actually got positive 5, negative 3. Not reassuring when you're almost breaking even, but at least it was more positive. It doesn't look like a social policy that you'd want to recommend, but at least on 8th grade math, it looked better than the others. On 4th grade reading, the next row, 5 and 5. What kind of wonderful social policy do you have when it's a flip of the coin whether a state will get better or not? On the next one, ACT exam, 6 negative, 3 positive. ACT scores go down. SAT scores, next row, go down. And it stands to reason that ACT and SAT scores will go down if you put in a standards-based curriculum. If you put in a standards-based curriculum, what you've done for your state is narrow the curriculum focus. SAT and ACT have as their domain high school in America. If they're sampling a broad domain and you've got a narrow domain, it's very likely your scores will go down. So in fact, by putting in a standards-based curriculum, you lost points on the SAT and the ACT. Your kid is less likely to get into Harvard if you have a strong standards-based, high-stakes testing state. Now, the difference is only 1 or 2 points, but, you know, it stands to reason that that would happen, and we found it. The dropout rates have gone up in 8 states with high-stakes testing, down in 5. High school graduation rates have gone down in 10 states. Down in 18 states and up in 5. GED enrollments went up in more states than they went down. The average age for the GED is down in 10 states. Younger people taking the GED. I just found this the other day and I threw it in. Now I have to explain it. On the top are 5 states, over on the right, New Jersey, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Indiana. 5 states that use multiple measures to get a high school degree. On the bottom are 5 states, South Carolina, Florida, New York, North Carolina, there's one other here, where is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay, maybe it's 5 and 4, okay, never explained it before, okay. Here's the point, Indiana's one of the ones that, okay, Indiana's not in that. There are 5 states that have tests only to graduate on the bottom, and 4 states that have multiple measures to get out of high school, okay? You will notice that the 4 states that have multiple measures to get out of high school have increasing high school graduation rates. You will notice that the 5 states that have exit exams, like your TACS and TAFS and whatever else this week you're testing kids on, whatever you have, those are states where they all go down. There are people who say putting in the high-stakes test doesn't affect high school graduation rates. We have researchers out there that are saying that. I'm looking at the same data. If the line goes down, you're losing kids. Okay? This is not a statistical issue. Okay? So there's the data on what high stakes tests can do. Okay. That was our first study. It received a number of criticisms, some of which were actually good, helped us to improve what we did, so we did a second study, and we designed that one differently. Let me describe that one to you. What we did was take 25 states for which we had complete data sets for, and we prepared big folders on these states. Texas was one of them. We did a sampling of newspaper articles for 5 years in Texas. We took the state laws about exit exams and testing, and we built a portfolio. We did the same for Massachusetts, Arizona, Wyoming, Kentucky. And then we used an old psychological method called comparative judgments, just noticeable differences. We took the two folders, and I go to a student, and I say, here's 2 states. Take about 2 hours each and make one judgment. Which state is putting more pressure on the kids, the teachers, and the administrators to achieve well? We have 25 states. That represents a matrix of about 300 comparisons. We had over 300 students, doctoral students. This is interesting. Where's the rest of my overhead that I did at midnight last night? I made it on a Mac, and a PC is rejecting it. Okay, there's supposed to be a wonderful picture there of the 25 states. I'll recall them for you in four of them. Of the 25 states, the 2 lowest on our ranking, meaning the least pressure, were Kentucky and Wyoming. The 2 highest, meaning the most pressure, were Texas and North Carolina. And right behind was Massachusetts and a couple of others. But Texas was 2nd in our rating as pressure on people, which you probably would agree with, pretty high out there. Here's the point though. We took the 25 states and we scaled them now. from lowest pressure to highest pressure, and then ask, well, how does the pressure, remember this is the theory of action, the pressure will motivate everybody. How does that result in NAEP scores? Let's see if this one came out. Okay. The results for NAEP reading. There is zero relationship of the PRI, that's the pressure rating index, with fourth grade reading scores. There is zero relationship with eighth grade reading scores. There's zero relationship in the cohort study of the gains between fourth and eighth grade reading. There is zero relationship between increases in pressure within a state over time and increases in scores over time. In other words, the theory of action that undergirds No Child Left Behind, yeah, that's an interesting type. Mac and PCs don't like each other. The theory of action that undergirds No Child Left Behind is simply false when it comes to reading. There's no evidence that the amount of pressure in a state is related to the test scores. When we move to mathematics in this study, there's zero relationship with 8th grade math scores, zero relationship between the gains between 4th and 8th grade, there's zero relationship of increases in pressure with increases in scores, and a strong correlation between the pressure rating index, the pressure in a state, and fourth grade math. And so we conclude the theory of action is inappropriate at eighth grade, but it seems to work for fourth grade. And our explanation at the bottom of this is that fourth grade math is amenable to heavy use of test preparation and drill and practice, and the test itself may be more predictable for teachers. Fourth grade math is fourth grade arithmetic. That's easy to drill on. So if you wanted to drill and kill because you're worried about your scores, you may get away with it. It may show up in fourth grade. It's not recommended. It would be nice if the kids understood math instead of, you know, how to get a math fact out, but that's a separate issue. That's a curriculum issue. The fact of the matter is, it looks like you can manipulate NAEP scores through drill and kill programs. Okay. So those are our studies. So now I said No Child Left Behind cannot work. I've also said it does not work. And then I wanted to leave you, in the next few minutes, I wanted to leave you with the notion that it's corrupting our profession. To do that, I need to share with you Campbell's Law. In 1975, Donald Campbell said, the more any quantitative social indicator is used for social decision-making, the more subject it will be to corruption pressures, the more apt it will be to distort and corrupt the social processes it is intended to monitor. In other words, as an indicator takes on value, you corrupt the people around the indicator, and you corrupt the indicator itself. Enron comes to mind immediately. Okay? Tyco. The business world is filled with the corruption of the indicators and the corruption of the people. The trial being held a few hundred miles from here today is a testimony to all of that. George Medalis called this the uncertainty principle, the Heisenberg principle applied to education. He said, the higher the stakes involved in testing, the less likely you are to get an accurate measurement of the construct you most want to measure. You're corrupting it. So you simply cannot have both high stakes and high validity, because the higher the stakes, the more corrupt the measure becomes. Thus, uncertainty about the meaning of a test score rises with increases in the consequences associated with scores on that test. That is, your validity goes down as your valuing of the score goes up. Okay? This is a social science law. To deny a social science law like any other scientific law is to do so at your own risk, and of course the people in Washington do so all the time. Let me show you some of my favorite examples of how this corruption works. The TSA, the Transportation Safety Authority, at the airports you all travel on, and me too, I came in yesterday, go out today, they check your bags, they wave wands over you, they decide if you're a terrorist or not. When they had the contract, Pearson, the publisher, also had the training contract, Pearson, to get the TSA online quickly when they decided to have all the inspections. Pearson was going to get a bonus if they got people into the jobs quickly. Well, that's Donald Campbell's law at work, that the indicator takes on value. Hundreds of thousands of dollars go to Pearson if they get people to pass the test that says they're proficient as a screener. So here's one of the questions on the 20-item test that was given to people when Pearson needed to get them at the airports. Here's one of the questions. How do threats get on board an aircraft? In carry-on bed? In checked-in bed? In another person's bed? All of the above. This is not hard, you know? This is not real difficult. Now, because they were having some trouble with this, this was one of the items given them in advance to study for. Okay. Senator Schumer looked at the items that were used, and he said, were these written by Jay Leno? Okay. The indicator took on undue importance. They corrupted everybody. It happened in basketball. You're a sports university. Georgia loves its basketball, perhaps more than you love your basketball. George is crazy. Jim Harrick Jr. taught a class for the basketball students. They had to get A's in the class because they got to play, you know, they got to make money for the university. Here are five items from the final exam in coaching basketball taught by Jim Harrick Jr. How many goals are there on a basketball course? A basketball court? Most basketball players could get that right. How many players are allowed to play at one time on any one team? How many halves are in a college basketball game? That's right out there with who's buried in Grants 2. How many points does a three-point field goal to count for a basketball game? And my favorite, because Jim Harrick Jr., the coach, understood the importance of performance items, he had their diagram, the half-court line. Okay. Understand, if those players didn't play, Georgia was going to lose an awful lot of money. The indicators then become corrupt because they take on too much value. My favorite in education is one from Ireland. After World War II, the Irish Ministry of Education says, we've got to get our kids writing better. So we're going to give them a writing prompt. They want us to write a paragraph, and then we're going to score the paragraph and see how our kids are writing. We said, fine. So they gave them a prompt. The prompt was the bicycle ride, 1946. And then the Ministry of Education passed this back to everybody and said, look, we got a paragraph like this. This is good writing. This is what we want the kids to do. And the paragraph read, I awakened early, jumped out of bed, and had a quick breakfast. My friend Mary Quant was coming to our house at 9 o'clock as we were going for a long bicycle ride. It was a lovely morning. White fleecy clouds floated in the clear blue sky and the sun was shining. As we cycled over Castlemore Bridge, we could hear the babble of the clear stream beneath us. Away to our right, we could see the brilliant flowers in Mrs. Casey's garden. Early summer roses grew all over the pergola, which stood in the middle of the garden. The Ministry of Education said to the teachers of Ireland, you know, a sixth grader who can write like this is what we're looking for. This is it. And they all said, gotcha. So the next year, 1947, the prompt was a day in the bog. And they got many items that looked like this. I awakened early and jumped out of bed. I wanted to be ready at 9 o'clock when my friend said he was coming down. Daddy said he would take me to the bog. It was a lovely day. White fleecy clouds floated in the sky. We go over the Castlemore Bridge. We can hear the babble of the book. There's Mrs. Casey. There's summer roses in the pergola. And the Ministry of Education said, no. We did not tell you to imitate the first paragraph. We told you that was an example of good writing. You have to strive for that. When we give you a day in the bog, we don't mean copy the stuff from, you know, the bus ride. Okay? So, can we do this again? Yeah, sure, we got it. Okay, everything's good. 1948. Prompt was a bus tour. I awakened early and sprang out of bed. I wasn't ready in good time. Now Nora Green was going to call me at half o'clock. It was another damn lovely morning with those damn white fleecy clouds and that damn Mrs. Casey was out there. If you put people's jobs on the line, you make the indicator so important, they will do what it takes to give you what you want. Okay? We have lots of evidence of that. In education, we have now looked, I'm finishing a book with my colleague Sharon Nichols over at UT San Antonio. Campbell's Law predicts that if we put high-stakes testing into place, we're going to find teachers cheating, and we do. We find them breaking standardization all the time. Breaking standardization is the equivalent to a statistician and a measurement person as cheating. Okay? It's the same thing. If I go by a kid taking a test, and I stand by that kid, and I do this. I have just screwed up the validity of that test. About 15% of teachers admit to doing that. Okay? Or they go over and they go. Okay? I've even seen a teacher stop in the middle of the test, go to the board and say, everybody, I'm here.
and reteach something. Now, I'm convinced the teacher wasn't doing it to get the scores higher for her credit. She was just frustrated that she had taught the kids and they didn't seem to understand it, okay? And teachers get frustrated, and I understand why they do that. But they're breaking the standardization, they're ruining the construct, the validity of the test. And we see that all the time. Breaking standardization, they increase drill, they put in inordinate amounts of time teaching to the test. One principal said to the teachers, "I want nothing new taught in the 6 weeks before this test." Yeah, I've got the quote. Nothing new taught, okay? Rudy Crew, who I like, is a friend of mine, crossed the line. I think he went to the dark side once. He was the superintendent in Tacoma. Well, let me tell you the story. You judge for yourself. The superintendent in Tacoma, and he was responsible for the Tacoma miracle. Kids went from like the 40th percentile to the 70th percentile in 9 months pre-post testing, and he had brought in a test company, and the test company drilled the kids, and the kids' scores went up. Rudy Crew was heralded as a miracle worker, and they recruited him for Chancellor of New York, and he went there. He's now Chancellor at Miami. He's a big shot superintendent. The day he left Tacoma, they fired the test prep company and the scores went back down. What does it tell you? Mm-hmm. Nobody was learning anything. They were learning, they were trained in how to take the test. It's an interesting comment, though, for those of you interested in the social justice issue. When the person who was running the test company that was drilling these kids to get their scores up on the test was confronted with this drop, and told, you know, you walked the line here. You were teaching them almost the exact formats that test was in. You were teaching them almost the exact items. And he said, "What's wrong with doing that for the kids in Tacoma? I live here on Fifth Avenue, and every parent here hires tutors for their kids to take the SAT to do exactly the same thing." That puts a little different moral light on what really is cheating. Okay? Complicates the issue for us. We saw teachers overcommitting time to the children's close to passing the test while ignoring those who are advanced in their work and those who are sure they will do poorly. Teachers do triage now. They're the good kids. I don't have to worry about them. They're the bad kids. They're useless. And they're these kids right at the bubble to proficient. I need to work with them. That's too bad. That's corruption. We saw teachers viewing students as either score increasers or score suppressors. They're not Johnny and Janie anymore. They're score increasers and score suppressors. We saw teachers leaving grades that have high stakes tests attached to them. So fourth and eighth and tenth grade you test, teachers are out of there. They have their seniority, they go to third, they go to seventh. Let the newest teacher deal with it, being the person you point the finger at. They leave schools with hard to teach children for schools that have easier to teach children. In states that give bonuses, they go where the bonuses are likely to be paid. So the rich get richer. The kids easiest to teach get the best teachers. We've seen administrators lying, cheating, forcing students out. Birmingham, Alabama, 522 students were dropped 3 days before the state tests were given. Who were the students? They were all black, but that's not unusual. Birmingham's pretty much a black school district. But they were called thugs, and they were dropped from the school roll. It just happened to be 3 days before the state testing. Scores went up in Birmingham. The principals, superintendent, and teachers all got bonuses. That's corruption, the indicator of corruption of the people. Houston is the poster child for corruption. I think Rod Page was the most corrupt superintendent America's ever seen, and he got to be secretary. But Houston simply lied about dropouts. Houston simply lied about college attendance rates. Houston's records are atrocious. New York City has the same thing. They force students out so the scores will go up. We've seen reducing curriculum time in social studies, art, music, physical education, even recess and nap time. The state school superintendent in Maryland said, "We are canceling naps. Students are not learning enough." Kindergartens. They cancel naps for little kindergarten. That's cruel, you know. I found a school district outside Boston, near Belmont, if you know the area, 7 minutes for lunch. Kids get McNuggets and wraps because they have to learn. Okay, elementary school. Boston also is the home of my favorite story about how we corrupt the educators in the over this. The armored truck came up in April, literally an armored truck with a guard with a gun, and delivered to the principal a big carton.
in the carton, the principal signs for it, in the carton with the state test, the MCAS, and the answer sheets. And you sign for it like, well, Wells Fargo delivers, you know. Shoot you, they steal it. Okay? The carton comes in, she signs for it, splits it open, and on top is a large Ziploc bag and a pair of latex gloves. She goes, I get that, what is this? She gets the instructions, and sure enough in the instructions are such things as, after administering the test, when the children throw up on the test, you are to put on your latex gloves and insert that test booklet into this large Ziploc bag and send it back with all the other tests because we have to keep the numbers straight. Okay, I thought two things about that. First of all, what kind of system did we create that intends little children to throw up because you're preparing for it? That means they throw up a lot, okay? So you have to prepare for barfing day, okay? But my mind is also a little perverse. I started thinking about the poor schnook in the State Department who months later has to open up those bags and check them in. Probably at minimum wages. Okay, our system has absolutely gotten corrupt. Okay, I could go on, but I'm pushing my hour, I'm at the hour mark. Let me end. Let me end by reminding you and all other citizens that the dissatisfaction of most teachers with these tests is something to take very seriously. We have been blessed in America historically because the profession of teaching has attracted a disproportionate number of people extraordinarily dedicated to the mission of children's welfare. In the economic sphere, in our businesses and industries, leaders and managers can only dream about employees approaching such levels of dedication to their corporate missions. Reform-minded business people and the government they control would do well to consider what is lost to America by alienating such a dedicated workforce, and what the cost to America might be of finding quality, effective replacements. Let me end, too, by asking you to think about what education really means. Think of what it means to be educated in a discipline where one learns to think like a scientist, a mathematician, an artist, or a historian. Think of what it means in the disciplines to pursue the meaning of truth, and its equally important opposite, what is false or indeterminate. Think of what it means to understand beauty and its equally important opposites, ugliness or kitsch. Think of what it means to deal with what is good and what is evil in this world of ours, because we do have good and we do have evil, and we must know the difference. And after you've done this kind of thinking, ask yourself if the assessment tools used for high-stakes testing are designed to measure these things, or are they likely to miss them completely? The scores we get from high-stakes tests cannot be trusted. They are corrupted and distorted. High-stakes tests cannot adequately measure the important things we really want to measure. The tests seem to have little or no effects on our students' overall learning, or their effects on learning are quite inconsistent, as we've demonstrated. And in fact, even when we get an effect, it may not be a causal effect, because lots of other things are happening simultaneously. We don't know if the tests are the cause of what's going on. Standards, accountability and assessment are not the enemies of our profession. High-stakes testing, however, is the enemy. High-stakes testing programs corrupt and distort the people in the education system, and that cannot be good for a profession as vital to our nation as is teaching. The promise of education is that it is not likely to be realized if we stay with this onerous system much longer. Thank you for the invitation and for listening.
Many thanks to Dr. Berliner for sharing these insights and ideas, as well as granting permission for his presentation to be shared as a podcast. This podcast, per his request, is shared under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 2.5 license. For more information about that license, you can click the link in the podcast show notes, and additionally refer to the podcast show notes for a copy of his slides and other materials related to the presentation.